We jokingly call it the most altered state in the Union.
Landscape ecologist Lisa Schultemore lives and works in a region of the United States known for a low density of humans, but a landscape that has been almost completely sublimated to human needs.
About 85% of the land cover in Iowa is covered with agriculture, and that's a combination of row crops and rangeland. But of that 85%, 86% is in crops. So absolutely, as you're driving across Iowa, the thing that's going to hit you in the face is the agricultural production. It is absolutely the most predominant thing on the landscape.
Schultemore conducts ecological research within that agricultural environment. She studies the causes, consequences, and design of land use change as an assistant professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. Among her varied pursuits is a collaborative project at the Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge near Des Moines, Iowa, that aims to fit a little more prairie in among the corn and soy.
So STRIPS stands for Strategic Trials of Row Crops Integrated with Prairie Strips.
The basic hypothesis? That converting just 10% of row crops to perennial prairie flowers and grasses, with their broad variety, staggered blooms and deeper roots, an adaptation to the Iowa landscape, could help keep soil, water, and fertilizers in the field, and perhaps boost biodiversity as well. Sediment, nitrates, and phosphates are major pollutants of Iowa waterways, with consequences for human and ecosystem health, both locally and far away in the Mississippi Delta, where fertilizers fuel algal blooms that threaten fisheries.
The project started out as a pure science experiment. We know, you know, native prairie composed of diverse mixes of grasses and wildflowers had all sorts of ecological function. We know that our current row crop system, you know, it's really good at crop production, but some of the other ecosystem functions are, would be a word for not so great, are impinged.
I'm Liza Lester, and this episode of Field Talk is the first in a series on land sparing and land sharing strategies for conservation. Is it better to intensively farm existing agricultural lands so that we may spare other lands for wildlife and preserves and parks? Or should we try harder to share our agricultural and urban areas with wildlife, though this may make our footprint larger?
And then I guess sort of the third reason we need to think about land sparing and land sharing is that I feel like it's our obligation to society to figure out how to maintain biodiversity everywhere, not just in the tropics or, you know, out on an island in the middle of the Pacific.
Lisa Schultemore spoke with me from her home in Ames, Iowa on July 2, 2013.
You're listening to an ESA podcast brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. ESA, promoting the science of ecology.
So my background is in forestry. So I worked on forest ecosystems prior to moving to Iowa 10 years ago. And then, you know, when you move to Iowa, well, one I was faced with, okay, I can either study these little parcels of postage stamps of forests in this landscape, or else I can travel to all my research sites. And both of those were kind of dissatisfying to me. And so I started looking at sort of the landscape around me, which was agricultural in character. That was kind of practical. But I think even earlier on in my career, I got kind of sick of working on environmental problems, and I really wanted to work on environmental solutions. From that standpoint, working on agriculture, it's like, you know, the world is your oyster. There's so much that could be done because agriculture has generally been the world of agronomists and engineers and not the world of ecologists. And I think I just saw this sort of wide open playing field in terms of what an ecologist could do in agriculture. And I just got super excited about it. It's kind of like a kid in a candy shop and, you know, having a hard time focusing on anything but wanting some of everything, right? And was lucky enough to, you know, fall in with a team of people here in the Midwest that were also really interested in thinking in different ways about how agriculture was put together. if you're tackling this big issue of agriculture in the 21st century, we're not going to solve it using siloed approaches. So it got me working with agronomists and, you know, those agricultural engineers and economists and engineers that are working on bioenergy and just, you know, all hydrologists, all sorts of different people, which is really exhilarating and fun. But then, you know, if you're working on agriculture, again, it's going to be all about privately owned landscapes. And so if you want anything to stick, it's got to work for the people that own and manage that private land. You know, it means working with farmers, and it means working with the people that talk to farmers. And so that's going to be, you know, the government agencies and acre businesses. And all of a sudden, the scope of who you need to talk with to, one, do your research, but then also make your research meaningful becomes very diverse and causes you to look at the world in very different ways. I like to always be learning, and this experience offers plenty of that kind of opportunity. Always learning to see things from, you know, the other point of view.
So there's been a lot of discussion, I think, at least among like foodies and people that are interested in agriculture, about the commodification of agriculture and how that changed agriculture in Iowa and the surrounding states. Could you talk a little bit about how agriculture has changed over the last 100 years?
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. One of the projects that I did when I first got here was kind of look back at agriculture's history, trying to figure out, okay, how did we get to where we are right now? And what does that mean in terms of where we could be going in the future? You know, how much path dependency is there in our current agricultural system? As a part of this project, we looked at sort of three different regions of Iowa that are very different landforms. We specifically chose these three different landforms because we thought that the signature on agriculture would be so different in these different places.
Because they have different soil, or just because the terrain is different?
A combination of the different terrain, the different geological history, which then, you know, is reflected in the soils. I was shocked at how similar the landscapes looked in the 1930s. It was all dominated by these, you know, small rectangle patches, right, that people think about when they think about agricultural landscapes.
Little farms. Individual families are running.
Exactly. Lots of little homesteads. And it wasn't just sort of crops like corn, but there were oats and hay and pasture lands and little woodlots in these landscapes. Today, these three, you know, townships are completely dominated by row crop production.
Are those primarily the same crops, like across Iowa, just a few crops, or is there diversity in the types of things people are growing?
Yeah, so in the past, there was a lot of diversity, and today it's highly dominated by corn and some soybean production. Okay, so in all cases, we're sort of taking the heterogeneity out of agricultural systems.
So we've really increased our efficiency for our food production by smoothing everything out, or at least we believe that's true.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the common misperceptions that people have when they look at agricultural states like Iowa, is they think about it being food production. But here we talk about it in terms of the four Fs: food, feed, fiber, and fuel. Actually, predominantly today, we are producing feed and fuel, and we actually don't produce all that much food. Of course, we're feeding a lot of that feed to animals, so cows, pigs, chickens, and other, you know, poultry. And approximately, you know, 35 to 40% of the corn crop goes to ethanol production. Very little of it ends up in actual food for direct human consumption.
And that has to do with the pricing, I guess, that they can what they, the best price they can get for their land, or is that, is it government programs? What goes, what's in the decision?
Yeah, what's in the decision? Let's see where to start. Absolutely. U.S. Federal Farm Bill policy has, is a huge driving force in terms of what people plant. I should add on that then the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, which is, you know, mandated renewable fuel, that that has a huge factor in people's decision-making. And a lot of that policy, the attempt has been to try to stabilize agricultural markets and take the some of the risk out of farming. Because as a business venture, farming is an incredibly risky business.
There's so many things that can go wrong out of your control.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I have to say that since I've been studying agriculture, there hasn't been an average year here in Iowa, right? Every year has its problems, either too much rainfall at harvest or too much water in the spring when you're trying to get planting, or like last year's drought or whatever. It's just every single year poses its own unique challenges. So it's an incredibly risky business. And, you know, society, because agriculture is so fundamental, because we need food, our society has decided that we'll take some of the risk out of that, that the government will bear some of that risk. And so that very well-intentioned ideal has driven U.S. farm policy since, you know, the 1930s. But of course, with any, you know, big policy driver, there's also all these unintended consequences. You know, we're still trying to figure out how to keep people on the land, keep people farming, produce enough cheap food that Americans can afford it. But, you know, now we have the emerging problems. You know, some of them aren't new. Of course, the 1930s was, you know, Dust Bowl days, and we knew about some of the challenges of cultivating lots of our landscapes and the impacts of extreme weather on that. But the water quality piece is becoming more and more salient over time.
What are the water quality issues that are arising from modern agriculture?
Yeah, so we here in Iowa, we talk about four main problems with water quality, or four main pollutants. You know, too much nitrogen in the form of nitrate, too much phosphorus, too much sediment, and then bacterial contamination as well. Those are, you know, so large and persistent that we haven't even gotten to talking about some of the newer problems, like with, you know, antibiotics in the waterways and other organic chemicals. So we tend to focus on those four here in Iowa.
Well, let's talk a little bit about STRIPS and how STRIPS, the STRIPS project, is looking at solving some of these problems.
Yeah. Our hypothesis was that, okay, let's put these two things together. Let's put little strips and patches of native prairie in the row crops and see if we can't boost the ecological functioning of those areas while still maintaining the area for predominantly crop production. And so our idea was that you interject a little bit of prairie, you boost all these ecological functions. Those ecological functions can then be used to support agriculture itself, as well as mitigating some of those downstream impacts of agriculture to the rest of society.
So it could actually help the crops themselves and improve the situation for agriculture as well as for the ecosystem. It's not like in opposition to agriculture.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was our initial hypothesis. And so we implemented the experiment in 2007, and there's four treatments. So one is, and they're in these little, they're crop fields, but they're, you know, small little catchments so that we could collect all of the water and sediment that is coming off of that land. So the treatments are all crops, and all the crops are in management, we call no-till management, where we're not cultivating the soil.
Okay, so you just punch in the seeds through the mat. You don't
exactly
till it.
Exactly. The second one is 90% of the little catchment in crops and 10% of it in the diverse native prairie, with all of that prairie located at the base of the catchment, so right before the water would flow out of the field. The third one is, again, 90% crop, 10% prairie, but instead of having all the prairie at the base, it's in these strips that run along the contour at multiple points up the catchment.
So interlaced into the farm fields.
Exactly.
How wide are the strips?
The strips vary in width because, again, we tried to make it so that it's 10% of the total area in the catchment. They vary between about 15 and 30 feet in general, though. But it's not a set width. And then the fourth treatment is that same strip design, but with 20% of the catchment in prairie and 80% in crops. We implemented this in 2007. And like with many ecological experiments, we expected, you know, that it would be many years before we saw any kind of result, right?
It's a long-term plan.
Yeah, it's okay. Long-term. Most ecology, you know, there's lag effects in the system or the processes work slow, so you just have to wait. Well, we were shocked in that we saw very strong benefits of the strips right away the next year in 2008. So I don't know if you remember, but 2008 was a really heavy rainfall year here in the Midwest. It was
Is that the year that Mississippi was flooding everywhere?
Yes, it was flooding everywhere. The city of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, was much of the downtown area was underwater. Iowa City, you know, the Iowa University of Iowa campus flooded. 2008 was a extreme year, you know, beyond 500-year flood event in Iowa. The strips, which, you know, we're barely beginning to really establish. I mean, here we do a lot of prairie reconstruction, and we tell people, you know, it's not going to look good until at least 3 years in, right? It takes 3 years to establish a prairie. We were shocked when we were looking at the data associated with the experiment and seeing that the strips were already providing some of the ecological function that we were expecting that they would that early on.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's kind of exciting.
It was. It was really exciting. We were so surprised. In the three different treatments in the experiment that had the strips in comparison to the treatment that was just all row crops, we saw 95% less sediment transport. We saw 90% less phosphorus in those water samples, 90% less nitrogen in those samples, 60% total amount of water coming out of those catchments. And then over time, we've begun to really understand sort of some of the biodiversity responses as well. But those water quality measures right off the bat were just so striking. And the really cool thing is that those numbers, you know, 95% less sediment, 90% less phosphorus and nitrogen, 60% less water, those numbers have pretty much held up across the 5 years of the experiment. So 2008, heavy rainfall year. 2009, kind of average. 2010, again, a heavy rainfall. 2011, kind of average. Last year, drought year. Regardless of these different sort of weather conditions, we're seeing those same basic numbers.
So it wasn't just because you had a big rainy year and it was especially important to keep water back.
Exactly. Most ecological data are really messy and all over the place. And the consistency across years has been really surprising. Why do we see such a big reduction in with just a little bit of prairie? And why is it consistent across years? You know, the prairie, it creates a mat that covers the soil. There's a lot of roots in that ground. And so it's holding that soil in place. It also has stems that stick straight up in there. They've got very stiff composition. It has so many things to go around. It really slows down. It helps the water infiltrate.
So it's like it's slowing down the water that would be running off the surface and either helping it soak in or just because it's moving slowly, things are falling out of it.
That's exactly right. Yep. You know, because the prairie is there all year round, it's also going to be pumping a lot of water back up to the atmosphere in comparison to, you know, the crops, which are going gangbusters in, you know, June and July and part of August. But, you know, the rest of the year, there's nothing, not much there in terms of biological material that's actually going to be, you know, taking in water, taking in nutrients, and either assimilating them into the plant itself or then, you know, or in the case of water, pumping it back up to the atmosphere.
So even if you're leaving it, you know, you're not tilling and turning the dirt over, mm-hmm. just because the crops have been cut down and are dead and you don't have, you know, life processes going on, and that makes a difference.
Yeah.
Was there a difference between the different organization of the 10% prairie within your plots, whether it was down at the bottom of the catchment or interlaced? That didn't matter?
We don't see a difference between the three treatments in terms of the water parameters, which also surprised us.
Yeah.
We expected that there would be, you know, some differences, but we're not seeing them. I should clarify that. We're not seeing them yet. And this might be one of those things where, you know, there's lag effects in the system or the processes take a long time. And so we're not seeing them yet. But in terms of over the last, you know, 5 years that we've been collecting data, the treatments with prairies themselves have not been separating themselves. It's really the difference between anything with a little bit of prairie versus the just plain no-till row crops.
That's remarkable. Do you think that that will be different for biodiversity questions?
So we're looking at three aspects of biodiversity: plant biodiversity, bird biodiversity, and insect biodiversity. Overall, we're seeing a huge increase in the diversity of native plants in these catchments. In fact, it's a 380% increase, which is in itself isn't surprising because we planted a lot of that, right? We planted the prairie. But what is surprising is that we planted a 35 species mix, and the average species diversity now in the strips is like 55 native species.
Wow, so you get volunteers.
Yeah, and we don't know yet where they're coming from, if they were just there in the soil seed bank or if they're blowing in or being carried on animals. That's not something that we know yet. But we do know that, you know, the native species has increased. Again, there's not clear separation among the treatments. In terms of the birds, we're seeing a 118% increase in native bird richness and 133% increase in native bird abundance. For some smaller birds like common yellowthroats and dixisoles, what we're seeing is that we can basically pack more territories in the strip configuration as opposed to all at the base. So if it's all at the base, you're only going to have one, you know, dixisole and one common yellowthroat there. There's just not enough sort of space there for them to fit another territory in.
They're really programmed to have and need a certain amount of territory to defend.
That's what it seems like. But if you have it in sort of three different strips, then what we're seeing is that you'll get like three different dixisoles and three different common yellowthroats out there. So they're using the strip predominantly for, you know, their foraging and such, but they sort of recognize that buffer space to them that the crops are providing. They're not feeling like they're rubbing elbows with that other male, right? Because there's like this intervening space.
It's like neutral territory.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, demilitarized zone or something.
So. And the crop space isn't like, it just doesn't have the kind of insects that they want to be foraging for, and they're not really going into that area.
They will use it to some extent. What we're seeing is that, you know, there's a ton of insects in the prairie strip. In fact, it's not that different than, you know, in the same area of reconstructed prairie. But comparing the strip to the crop field, you know, there's not much in terms of insects in that crop field itself. And I have to say that, well, with the bird piece, there's one thing that we still need to fill in the gap. So we've just looked at it in terms of abundance and richness. We haven't gotten to the point where we've been able to rigorously look at bird fecundity. And we have done some nest searching to start moving in that direction. But basically, our experiment is so small right now that we just can't pack in enough birds and enough nests to get a real rigorous estimate of bird productivity on these sites. So we're looking forward to phase two, which I'll talk about in a little bit, where we can, you know, get this over more extensive areas and begin to get more enough nests so that we can get an estimate of whether these strips from a bird perspective are functioning as sources or sinks or, you know, traps for these bird populations, which we just don't know at this point.
So there's the potential that you could be luring birds into habitat that just isn't that good for them and that they're not actually thriving there, even though they're finding
exactly
place to establish themselves.
Exactly. That's the potential. So with the insects, there's a lot more insects in the prairie than there is in the crop fields. The crop fields, however, still have a lot of insects in them, more than what we would have really expected. But again, I have to sort of provide the caveat that this whole experiment is located within a wildlife refuge.
Okay, so it's not in the usual like surrounding environment you would find in most of Iowa, where you'd be surrounded by other farm fields.
Exactly, exactly. So we don't know, you know, how much of that conclusion is really based on sort of that landscape context, and which of it is a pure result of our experimental design.
So if you were thinking about porting this to something that the farmers could actually do and implement, does it matter to them whether, you know, like where the strips are? How difficult is it for them to put in strips of prairie, you know, using the equipment that they have and like still maintain the level of efficiency they need to make a profit?
Right. Yeah. So we are moving towards phase two in the experiment, which is putting this out, the experimental design out basically on working farms. And we have three farmers signed up already.
How hard was it to get people to volunteer?
You know, this is one of these experiments where I don't know if the timing is right or the idea is right or, you know, just what it is. But there's a lot of interest in this project from the standpoint of farmers and agricultural stakeholders, as well as people active in conservation in the state. And our team is kind of now retooling to figure out how do we effectively address the flow of requests.
So you have more volunteers than you can actually incorporate into the program at this point.
Right, exactly, which is a good problem to have. But, you know, our goal is that, hey, wouldn't it be cool if this really works and, you know, really effectively addresses a lot of the main problems with agriculture in Iowa today, or, you know, the Corn Belt today, without having, you know, huge dramatic impacts on people's, you know, farming operations. And wouldn't it be cool if this goes hog wild? But from the sort of science standpoint, we're still at a point where it's like, oh, you know, these are really cool results from one, you know, experiment in one location that's replicated just four times. We want to work very closely with the farmers that want to do this so that we can have the design implemented in a way that we're going to be able to get really good data and then also be able to collect that data so that, say, another 5 years from now, we can make really strong recommendations that we're confident in terms of, you know, having people adopt this, the prairie strips practice.
Logistically, how challenging is it to fit your basically field work into their working farm schedule?
Right. Well, we'll still maintain our experiment at the wildlife refuge. And the reason why it's at that refuge is because we can have the level of control that we need to have a, you know, rigorous scientific design. What we're trying to do with this phase two implementation is make sure of a few things. One, we're just wanting to test the 10% strips configuration. We want people to have the prairie out there, but, you know, have it in the multiple strips running along the contour rather than all at the base.
So interlaced into the field.
Yeah, interlaced into the field. Thanks. So we're simplifying, you know, the design that way. And then in terms of what they are putting in the strips, we're trying not to be too prescriptive because prairie seed is really costly.
I wouldn't have thought about that, but yeah, it makes sense.
Especially in comparison to the conservation cover that farmers are used to planting, which is like a monocultural brome grass, you know, exotic cool season grass. So that's really cheap. And so the prairie seed, you know, at $200 an acre or something is going to be much more expensive for them. We want people to get a mix of native warm season grasses, cool season grasses, and forbs, so wildflowers. We would like for those wildflowers to have different species bloom across the entire growing season. So there's always a flower out there for those pollinator and insects, many insects are pollinators, but yeah, there's always flowers out there because for the insect communities, having those floral resources is absolutely critical.
And then do you provide them with kind of like a list of options, or are farmers fairly knowledgeable on that?
Yeah, we work with them, lining them up with potential seed dealers and then also providing them with an assessment of the list of seeds and whether there's, you know, something missing or if we would prefer to, you know, have another species added or whatever. But again, recognizing that once you start talking about really diverse seed mixtures, it gets pretty costly very quickly.
Let's move a little bit into the land sparing, land sharing question. I don't know if it's really a duality. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit.
Well, I don't think it's a question of either or. I think we need both land sparing and land sharing. And there's a really great paper out there that I think outlines, you know, why we need both. It was actually published in Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment in 2006. It's by Jorn Fischer and some colleagues. And the title of the paper is Biodiversity, Ecosystem Function, and Resilience, 10 Guiding Principles for Commodity Production Landscapes. So notice the focus on commodity production. Their first strategy is maintain and create large structurally complex patches of native vegetation. In other words, reserves. So, you know, here's a paper about, you know, maintaining biodiversity and function and resilience and commodity production landscapes. And sort of their first recommendation is we need a land sparing strategy, right?
So they were thinking like more than just a strip in an agricultural field, but actually like a reserve of, I don't know, acres inside?
Yeah. Like large, like tens of thousands of acres, right?
Okay, so they're thinking of like a big reserve, but not a whole lot of them, not like a patchwork of them on every farm.
Yeah, exactly. So we can talk a little bit more about that, but then as you get down in some of the other strategies, there are ones that we think about more when we think about land sharing. So in creating corridors and stepping stones between the reserves, you know, buffering the sensitive areas like lakes and streams are also in those recommendations. I think, you know, there's a bunch of reasons why we need to move away from land sparing or land sharing and think about this as, you know, a combined strategy, or maybe start saying land sparing and land sharing.
And thinking about where the most appropriate, you know,
combination practices
is.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But I think why we need to move towards that is, first of all, we need that ecological function and biodiversity to maintain the commodity production itself. When we think about key ecological functions like decomposition, pollination, building and maintaining fertile soils, absolutely ecological processes are critical to provide those services back to commodity production. And I'm just going to talk about in terms of, you know, providing those services back to agriculture. Right now, probably the top concern among agriculture in the agricultural realm itself is that soil fertility piece. You know, how do we maintain soil quality into the future? The NRCS is having a big campaign right now on soil quality. I've interacted with some folks from agribusiness, and one of their main concerns as we move forward is that they're not going to be able to meet their yield goals without increases in soil quality. So I think the agricultural community is really recognized that, hey, we need to pay a lot more attention to the growth medium, soil, going into the future. Whereas, over the past decades, we've put most of our focus into that seed, right? That seed resource, and that we can't do everything that we want to do by just focusing on that seed. And so I think the discussion is getting a lot broader. People are starting to understand that.
So maybe there's opportunities for cooperation there.
Yeah, absolutely. But then, other reasons why we need to think about land sparing and land sharing is, secondly, we need to mitigate the impacts of that agricultural production. Think about Des Moines and the largest nitrate removal plant in the world, the water quality concerns, think about, Cedar Rapids flooding. We need that flood control. Those are sort of, two Corn Belt centric examples, but on a global scale, we need to think about our ability to sequester more carbon within agricultural systems.
And perennial grasslands, they're presumably holding quite a lot of carbon.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. And that then again ties into the soil quality piece, is that, putting that carbon below ground and adding that to that soil food chain is going to be really important in sort of creating and maintaining the soil quality that we need to be attentive to if we're going to maintain productivity into the future. And then I guess the third reason we need to think about land sparing and land sharing is that I feel like it's our obligation to society to figure out how to maintain biodiversity everywhere, not just in the tropics or, out on an island in the middle of the Pacific. Partly it's because we know that, disturbances happen, and sometimes they're very large. And even though that they're infrequent, they can wipe out our reserves, unless we have our reservoirs of biodiversity, unless we have enough of them propagated throughout the landscape. But then also, I think a lot of people recognize that climate change is changing everything about how we think about how ecosystems are put together. Our current hotspots of biodiversity will need to be able to shift in the future. And how are they going to shift unless we sort of create a landscape that's amenable to those shifts?
There's nowhere for them to go.
Exactly.
Yeah. What do you think about the social angle? Because it's kind of striking that when you have land sharing, then people are seeing those environments and seeing the impact. I guess it also gives you opportunities for conflict. But do you think that it helps people to be more, feel less estranged from the reserves if the reserves are interlaced into their living areas?
I think, people are looking for high quality recreational experiences and, the ability to connect with nature in all sorts of new ways, right? I mean, nature just doesn't have to be in Yellowstone National Park, or it doesn't have to be in the tropical rainforest, but, nature can be right outside your back door. In fact, that's the way it's been for most of human history. Maybe I'm naive, but I think people are really starting or our society is really starting to see the effect of that lost connection. In my mind, a lot of these societal problems that we're grappling with today, environmental, social, and health, the solutions are all interlinked. And I think it has a lot. And I think a lot of the solutions lie in basically, redesigning our landscape so that we can be really strategic about interjecting in the ecological functions that we are absolutely critical for our human society moving into the future. But again, circling back, I feel as though there haven't been enough ecologist working in agriculture, and especially, you know, working on it from the standpoint of, you know, what's going to work in this place for this farmer? You know, how do we help him deal with, maintain his business, but also think about meeting those broader societal demands of environmental performance? It's been just an absolute blast getting to know the people and getting to understand the systems.
How is it difficult to break into different circles, different professional circles, into farming circles? How did you get started on that?
It's been a lot easier than I ever would have expected. As an ecologist, both when I went into, started really working a lot with forest managers, and now as an ecologist working with farmers, I'm really impressed by how open people are to discussing some of these hard issues. You know, Iowa farmers, they're incredibly, you know, hardworking and resilient, you know, because they work in a system that's always changing. They really understand that, you know, how it is right now isn't how it's been in the past, nor is it going to be like what it is in the future. And so I've been amazed at how, you know, open people are to discussing change. Doesn't mean that they're going to absolutely implement it tomorrow or even, you know, the next year, but they're incredibly open to discussing sort of their business decision making and what they've thought about in terms of other, you know, conservation practices. You know, what is the process that they would go through if they need to change their operation a little bit? They've been wonderfully open in discussing these things.
I'm definitely struck by, you know, it's not just scientists going and giving their time to the communities. You really sound like you've gotten a lot back from it, that it's contributing a great deal to your science and the way you think about the questions you want to ask.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't have said it any better. And I hear this, maybe, you know, this is even better. I hear this from my students all the time, both, you know, graduate students in my lab, as well as graduate students in the programs that I work in, and then undergraduates in my classes too. I think, you know, there's a real strong desire amongst upcoming cohorts of natural resource managers and scientists to really engage in positive and meaningful ways that really help us address sort of these environmental challenges our society faces, from local city or county scales all the way up to global scales. A lot of these young scientists, they totally get that sort of science needs to change to allow this, that the scientific reward structure needs to change to allow this, that, you know, universities really need to change to allow scientists who have, you know, the best knowledge about how our environment is working to work with communities to, you know, surmount these challenges. It's so exciting to see all of the energy in these people's eyes and, you know, the can-do attitudes and such. Anything that, you know, Ecological Society of America can do to continue to foster this shift and basically allow these young people the latitude to make huge strides in confronting our environmental challenges would be such a win for the society as well as society at large.
Stay tuned to Field Talk for more in our series on land sparing and land sharing. Next up, Sasha Gennett, an ecologist at the Nature Conservancy, talks about protecting food safety and wildlife habitat in California's Salinas Valley. Show notes and links to resources heard in our program are available at www.esa.org/fieldtalk. The bird song of the Dixicel heard at the top of the episode was recorded by Jonathan Jongsma at Dort College Prairie in Sioux, Iowa, in July of 2013. Bird and train sounds heard throughout the interview were present in situ, and our intro and outro music is provided by Dr. Nicholas Catelli. Thanks for listening.